Susie Judd and welcome to my podcast, Let's Talk Fertility. During my own fertility treatment and pregnancies, I was recommended to take vitamins and minerals to help support me. The benefits include regulating hormones, improving egg quality, reducing stress for both mind and body, and it also helped me personally to feel proactive in my role of preparing myself as best as I could. Pregnacare Conception and Wellman Conception vitamin and mineral supplements provide advanced nutritional support for both men and women trying for a baby, including zinc, vitamin D, and the exact levels of folic acid recommended for women by the UK Department of Health. Thank you to my sponsor, Pregnacare, expert nutritional care while trying for a baby. To find out more, visit www.pregnacare.com. So my guest today is author and fertility campaigner Jessica Hepburn. She is one of the UK's leading voices on fertility, infertility and IVF, and as you may remember, interviewed me for the first episode of this series. Jessica has inspired and moved me in the way she has spoken with so much positivity, strength, but also has been brave enough to show vulnerability, especially around the subject of infertility. Jessica decided to start a family at the age of 34 when running a London theatre, and in her words, she thought making the decision to fit a baby into her busy life was the hard part. But after a year of trying to conceive, Jessica was diagnosed with unexplained infertility. After a decade of trying to conceive, 11 rounds of unsuccessful IVF, multiple miscarriages, and an ectopic pregnancy, Jessica has decided to dedicate this next decade of her life to taking on some of the world's most iconic endurance challenges, such as swimming the Channel to raise awareness and money for children and adults without the families they long for. Jessica has written books, including The Pursuit of Motherhood and most recently 21 Miles. I was honoured to be invited to talk at the Fertility Fest this year, which is an arts festival dedicated to fertility, infertility, modern families and the science of making babies that Jessica founded in 2016. We met a year ago at the Fertility Show and connected on so many levels, but mainly with our desire to talk openly about fertility and also our want to improve fertility education for the next generations.
Izzy, what an introduction. Thank you.
Well.
I think I can die happy now.
I basically just wanted to start kind of at the beginning and wonder what was happening in your life when you decided to start a family.
Yeah. Well, I always say that, you know, I did what all good girls of my generation were told to do, went to university, got on the career ladder, always knew that I wanted to run a theatre. Up I climbed, and at 34, I was running, as you said, a big theatre in London, in West London, called the Lyric Hammersmith. I'd also met the man that I wanted to start a family with. I think the other thing that we're told as young women is that we need to be picky about the man that we choose. We need someone who's going to be our emotional and intellectual equal, and I felt that I'd found that. And I thought it was the perfect moment to have a family. And of course, it might have been the perfect moment if everything had gone to plan, but as you know, it didn't.
So at what point did you realise that it was going to be harder than you had imagined it to be?
Well, I think, and I know that this is something that you share and I think is really common, and partly because we're all, you know, it's drummed into us in school not to get, you know, that we must not get pregnant. And the moment we throw away contraception, we're going to get pregnant. And so, like many women, I thought the first month we were going to get pregnant, and it was a surprise when we didn't. And then 1 month turns into 3 months, turns into 6 months, turns into a year. I mean, where I'm a little different from your story, because I know after that first month, you know, having interviewed you, that you were immediately worried that something was wrong. And you obviously had an instinct. Mm. You know, I know you've talked about the fact that you felt that it might be difficult to get pregnant, but I didn't feel that at all. And of course, what we're told is you need to try for a year before you seek any sort of help. So it did take us a year before we went to a fertility clinic.
And within that year, were you calm? Did you feel did you sort of think, well, this might take a bit of time? Or were you starting to think, okay, why is this not happening? And yeah, where were you sort of emotionally?
That's a really good question. I think there's a sort of a gradual increasing sense of unease. I mean, certainly, you know, I was 34. Many of my girlfriends that I'd been to school with or been to university with were trying to get pregnant around the same time. You know, they weren't getting pregnant immediately either. I remember, like, I mean, I didn't even know what an ovulation predictor kit was when I started. And then I remember my best friend saying, you know, there's this thing that you can get in Boots and it tells you when, you know, when to have sex. And so, you know, we were in it together. But like gradually, one by one, after several months, they would fall pregnant and I wasn't. And so there was that sort of, yeah, increasing sense of something's not right.
So did you feel, because I know, for example, you know, I would share with my girlfriends, oh, you know, legs, we're keeping the legs up in the air and, you know, should I go to the loo? And, you know, all those sort of humorous conversations that you have suddenly don't become funny anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, and I, you know, over a glass of wine in the pub and you're talking about it and, oh, well, let's just have fun trying.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're not drinking anymore because you're worried that alcohol, you know, is going to affect your chances to conceive. You're not drinking coffee. You know, all these things we then start to punish ourselves with because we think there's something, you know, that we're doing wrong or that we could be doing better. And I think that's one of the really hard things.
Yeah. I've heard you say that you decided not really to tell many people initially about your struggle. Was there a moment that you decided to start talking about it, or did you keep it very much to yourself in the early stages?
Yeah, and I don't think that I am unusual in this. I think many people do keep it close, you know, and I think society has encouraged us to do that because, of course, you know, it's accepted that we don't tell people that we're pregnant for the first 3 months in case something goes wrong. So I think a lot of people are sort of secretive about it. I mean, contrary to what my life looks like now, because, you know, it's out in the world, I am also an intensely private person. And so I really didn't tell anyone, not even my closest family and friends. I mean, gradually, as the, you know, story went on, it started to come out. I mean, you mentioned my ectopic pregnancy, and when I found myself being rushed to hospital, you know, I had to ring work and say, I'm not coming in today, I'm going into hospital. And then suddenly, you know, people started to know. But for a long time, I really didn't tell anyone. And I think a lot about why was I so secretive about it. And I think there are lots of different reasons. And I think, you know, I didn't feel like a proper woman for a long time. I couldn't do what every other woman finds so easy to do. And I was really ashamed of that. And I was also really hoping that next month I was going to be able to join the Mummy Club too. I was going to cross over and I could put this nightmare behind me and no one need know.
Yeah.
And I also think, you know, there's something about, you know, women have fought for so long to be seen as more than wives and mothers. And I had the job of my dreams.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to, you know, be ungrateful for that. I didn't want anyone to think, well, now she doesn't want a job, all she wants to be is a mother. You know, what I really wanted was both.
Yeah.
And I think this real mix of feelings were the things that made me so secretive.
Do you think if your diagnosis had been medical, that it might have been easier? Do you think that because you had been told you had unexplained infertility, did that therefore make you feel you needed to justify?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, a really interesting question because obviously when you first get that diagnosis, it feels like a good thing because the doctor is saying to you, well, everything looks like it's in working order. You can get pregnant. So you think, oh, well, I will get pregnant. And you certainly think that once you're down the IVF route, you'll definitely get pregnant because that's what IVF is designed to do. I mean, I've changed my view on that now. I think unexplained is the worst possible diagnosis because they have no idea what's wrong. And obviously, getting a diagnosis means that they know what's wrong and they can work out whether they can fix it or not, or maybe work out that they can't fix it and tell you, no, you can't. We can't fix this, or we can do. You might have to have donor eggs, or you might have to have donor sperm, and then you can make a decision. But if you've got unexplained infertility, how do you? You're just in limbo.
How do you move forward? Mm. And so, did you? How long was it before you decided? Okay, we're going to try IVF.
Well, we had the initial tests after a year. Then, like many people, we found ourselves, and I think same for you, going down an IUI mm-hmm. route, which I call IVF light, and that was pretty disastrous. Because the clinic we were at the moment, I mean, I was very, very paranoid in the early stages of fertility treatment about the clinic mixing up.
Yes, I
write about this in my book, mixing up, my partner's sperm with somebody else's sperm.
And you actually followed the sperm, didn't you?
Yes,
Jessica?
Yeah, exactly. I know.
The room where the sample was taken.
It is a bit embarrassing, Izzy, because, I mean, I have become a public figure in the fertility world now, so people do know who I am because of my writing and campaigning and the festival, as you've mentioned, but also every doctor and embryologist who has met me never forgets me because I am, like you, a control freak. And yes, that first clinic experience was terrible. And then we moved on to IVF, and it was the start of what became 11 rounds of IVF.
11
ultimately.
Rounds. Was there any stage during that time that you thought that this is almost becoming addictive?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, when my first book came out and I was doing a lot of press and media, I did an article in the Daily Mail and they had a headline by my head which was "Addicted to IVF." typical Daily Mail headline. I'd never thought of it as an addiction until that point. And then, of course, everything exploded. I was on This Morning with Holly and Philip saying, are you addicted to IVF? And at that point, I just thought, well, it is a bit like an addiction because I think it's exacerbated because you're on this roller coaster, to use a cliche, but it's true. You're on this roller coaster against time. You start to know that every month that passes, every year that passes, that you're running out of time and you become sort of desperate. And also all your friends are leaving you behind. You feel you're living your life in limbo. You can't start life, the life that you're imagining. And I think all these, circumstances create a sort of really toxic and desperate situation that does start to feel a bit like an addiction. And, I've never taken drugs, but I also know that I can imagine that when you start a round of IVF, you're full of hope. You think this is going to be it. And it's a sort of like a rush, And then it doesn't work. And then you sort of want it again because you think, well, next time it might work. So, I mean, there are similarities.
When I was reading The Pursuit of Motherhood, I couldn't believe how many times you picked yourself up. You didn't want to give up that hope. And I think also what I found so hard to read was that you had so much bad luck. You think, how much more can one person actually take when you write about your miscarriages and then the ectopic pregnancy, which was so, dangerous. What actually happened?
It happened after a round of IVF. I mean, one of the things I always advise people, please take a blood test, even if you think the IVF has been is negative because you've been bleeding, or you take a urine test and it's negative, because you can only really tell from an HCG blood test. And I was, in fact, pregnant. And then my period didn't, you know, didn't go back to normal. And I thought, well, that's probably to do with the IVF, because it can sort of muck up your cycles. And to cut a long story short, I ended up a few months later taking a pregnancy test, and I was pregnant. And shortly after that, we went into the doctor to have a scan. You know, we were sort of really excited, and I could just tell immediately from his face that something was seriously wrong. And I was, at that point, over 3 months pregnant. A perfect baby, but in the wrong place, and in my particular circumstance, in my stomach. And so suddenly I found myself being rushed into hospital. You know, yes, I did have an enormous amount of bad luck, but I suppose I did think that, like, well, if we keep on trying, if we work hard at it, we'll get there in the end. Doctors certainly said that the fact that I could get pregnant was a really good sign. That was another reason why we continued.
It's almost harder to let go because the possibility is always there. It's not like someone is saying to you that there's a reason.
Yeah.
So why would you not, you know, keep trying?
That's right.
If you could give yourself some advice going back to when you were 34 at the start, is there anything you feel you would say to yourself or do differently?
Well, one of the things I always say is that I lost a decade of my life to Project Baby. I mean, it's a phrase that you use as well, I think. And I heard this brilliant thing recently. Someone said, don't stop living while you're trying.
Yeah.
And I think that's what so many women do, and men, I'm sure, as well. They stop living their life. And, you know, I was on this fertility journey for a decade.
Yeah.
And that is a long time. And obviously going through 11 rounds of IVF is the extreme end of the spectrum. But most people who are on this journey are on it for quite a few years. I mean, how many years from the start to getting Lola? I mean, several years.
Yeah, exactly. Three years, yeah.
And, you know, that's loss. You can lose that time. And life is so short. So, you know, whenever I give advice to people, I say, don't lose Project You for Project Baby, because there are so many other things that you want for your life.
Yeah.
Beyond this.
Were you surprised by how family or friends responded to your situation? Did you lose any friendships, or were you shocked by how people, you know, the longer it went on and friends around you were starting to have families, and did you find that people weren't inviting you to things, or, you know, was that difficult?
Oh, I think it's really hard, and you do lose friendships on both sides, because sometimes it's really hard for you to be around other people, and, you know, it becomes hard for them as well. I mean, I have this thing which is that, you know, I talk about the pain of not being able, struggling to conceive, as being the pain of never, and it's like, and one of the symptoms of that is you know, being invited to baby showers and christenings, and how hard that is. But on the flip side, there's an equal pain when people stop inviting you.
Yeah.
Because
you want it to be your choice.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, it's no one's fault. It's just a horrible thing. People's lives start to move on. You know, you're not sitting in the pub after work anymore having a glass of wine because they're at home looking after their children. And when you call your friends, they can't focus on the conversation because the baby's crying in the background. That's no one's fault, but it's a really, really hard situation. And I think by talking about it, by writing about it, by telling the world about it, as we are both doing, we're making it better, hopefully for ourselves, but most importantly for the people coming after us. And what I would say about when I wrote my book, because obviously then suddenly what had been very private was out in the world, is the, and I think that, you know, just even the microcosm of telling, you know, you don't have to go and write a book about it, but you might decide to tell some people, to be aware that some people that you're closest to won't react in the way that you want them to react. And that's hard, but that's the way it is. And some people that you might not be very close to at all will react in an astonishing way and give you so much support.
Yeah.
And that's the flip side bonus.
What is the support that you got that made such a difference to you? What was it that people could do that helped you?
When I was prepared to say to the world, this is what I've been going through, this is my most vulnerable self,
mm-hmm.
this is the thing that I'm so ashamed that I can't do, is making me so sad. You know, the wonderful thing about human beings is that they love you anyway. They give you a reason to enjoy the world anyway. And also, in saying that stuff, you also realise that what's so big in you, and you think you're wearing it like a placard on you and that everyone's looking at this sign saying, Jessica, failed woman, is that they don't see that at all. You're Jessica, their daughter, their sister, their friend, who they've known all their life, or their boss or their colleague, and they think all these other things about you. They don't. And I think that's the thing. It's so huge when it's inside us, but the moment we let it out, it becomes smaller, and that makes it easier. And it makes it easier for everyone. And now, let me tell you, my life is out there in the world, but it's just no one cares about it anymore, you know. And also, they also give me a huge amount of support.
We both decided to write about our stories, and I think probably both agree how therapeutic that is, actually, to put it down. And we've talked about how people that have written have said to us, how much they needed to write things down. And I know certainly when I'm writing my book, how much it helped me to talk. Obviously, you've written two books, most recently 21 Miles, which is one of your crazy endurance challenges that you have decided to take on in this decade of your life, which is swimming the Channel, which is 21 miles.
Yes.
And you met 21 women, basically asking the question, does motherhood make you happy? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that book and the women that you met? And sorry, lots of questions in one, but I find it fascinating what you've done with this book. So yeah, tell me a bit about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was 43 when I came out of my 11th round of IVF, and I thought I need to do something different with my life. I didn't know at that point what the next steps were, if any, on my motherhood journey, but I thought I needed to do something different. And that was where the sort of crazy idea to swim the Channel started. It was a childhood dream, but a childhood dream I hadn't actually thought about for 30 years. So I now call it my childhood dream turned midlife crisis. I had no idea what was involved when I set out, the fact that it's one of the sort of toughest physical and mental endurance feats on the planet. But hey, I'd just been through 11 rounds of IVF. That's another one.
Yeah.
I was pretty well equipped. And I started out on this journey. And there are many things I learned about it that are horrific. Like, you can't wear a wetsuit because Captain Matthew Webb, who first swam the Channel in 1875, didn't wear a wetsuit.
So no one else can.
So no, if you want to be an official Channel swimmer, you can't. And the only way to keep warm then is a little bit of human padding. So it is a license to eat. And I don't know about you, but food is my unadulterated pleasure in life. And so I then had this idea, what if I were to write to 21 famous and inspiring women and ask them to meet and eat with me to help me get fat, to swim the channel, and answer the question, does motherhood make you happy? And it might help me decide what I needed to do next. Did I need to find some way of becoming a mother? Or could I have a fulfilling life without children? And so I met these amazing women from different walks of life, some mothers, some not. They, you know, all of them had interesting stories about motherhood. You know, they adopted or had been through egg donation or fostered. And it was really, you know, so the book is about my sort of meeting these incredible women. Of course, we talked about many things beyond motherhood as well. And I suppose that goes back to what you were saying before about asking me about people. You know, like, you get such strength, even from strangers. You know, we had these incredibly life-affirming, inspirational conversations.
And who took you by surprise? Was there somebody that you met that you were expecting a different story from about what motherhood meant to them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, every conversation I had was incredibly important to me. But I think one of the really... I met with the Reverend Lorna Hood, who is honorary chaplain to the Queen. And she, I asked her what was more important, her vocation as a religious leader or being a mother. And I thought she was really candid and said, I would give up my job for my family, but I would never give up my family for my job. And she urged me to find some way, somehow. And I just thought that was such an... I mean, all the conversations I had were really honest. But I just thought that was... so interesting, coming from, you know, a religious leader. I met with Prue Leith, the new Queen of Bake Off, who's got, I don't know if you know, she's got one adopted child and one biological child. We had a really frank conversation about adoption and about how it's not for everyone. You know, the often thing that people say to you is, why don't you just adopt? There is no just in adoption. And that conversation was really interesting. But I think of all the women I met, the thing that I really learn is that everyone has a sadness in their life. Mine happens to be that I've not been able to have a biological child with a man that I love. But everyone has something, and you know, you've got to try and I think this is something you say in your book as well, Izzy, and that, like, you've got to try and make something good out of the bad stuff. And that's what I've tried to do, and that's what I did with the swim.
So you mentioned then about adoption and people saying, why don't you just adopt? Did you, or have you, looked at other ways of becoming a mother? And, you know, what has been difficult for you in terms of with that path?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the book is very much about exploring that. And I mean, one of the conclusions that I came to, I met with another woman I met with was Jodie Day, who for me is the leading voice of childless women in this country. And she said, well, have you got an answer to your... I met her towards the end of all the women I met coming close to my channels. She said, well, have you got an answer to your question? And I was like, gosh, what is my answer? And she said, well, maybe... She said, there's this lovely Rilke quote that I think would sort of suit you. She said, maybe life is living the question. And I really love that, because obviously biological parenthood has a very finite time. But there are other routes to parenthood. And I really learned... I met... a past pop sensation who's anonymous in the book, who had her first baby at 56 through egg donation. I think there is fostering and adoption. I met someone who'd fostered over 100 children. I also think that there's a way to be a mother in the world without being a parent. I think some of the work that I do now in supporting you know, I do a lot of work trying to improve fertility education for the next generation so that they have the best chance of having the families they want and don't have to go through what I went through or mm-hmm. you went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a mothering act. So,
yeah.
So I sort of, I'm quite happy at the moment living the question of what motherhood might look like for me in some way, some shape or form in the future.
Yeah.
Whilst accepting that biological motherhood is probably highly unlikely, unless right. there's a miracle. I'm not Sherry Blair.
So obviously we have spoken about fertility education and our feelings about how important it is to teach the next generation about fertility. We're both, you know, brought up with education, which is basically how not to get pregnant, which is, of course, so important. But we're not taught about how to look after our fertility. Mm. And that's for boys and girls. It feels like something does need to change. And obviously, I've been working with you on Fertility Fest, which you founded, which is an amazing arts festival, which is basically giving us a good impression of what the modern family is now. What is it like in particular that you feel with fertility education that could be changed? Like, what are the small steps that we could be doing?
Well, I just think young people need and deserve a more rounded approach to fertility education. I mean, through Fertility Fest, I'm campaigning on a number of fronts, but I have to say to you that on the fertility education front, like, whenever I say to anyone what we get taught in schools is how not to get pregnant, everybody agrees.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely definitive. And of course, as you say, that is really important. But I don't think that young people are taught enough about the fertility life cycle. I mean, in your particular case, you struggled to conceive in your 20s when you were trying to get pregnant at the biologically optimum age. But I think what's really interesting about your case with in terms of having PCOS is that you weren't told that that might affect your fertility.
Yeah.
And I think...
And my naivety. You know, I was embarrassed to go to an IVF clinic at my age.
Yeah.
Because I just made the assumption that people did that in their 40s and that was the reason why you had IVF.
Exactly. Yeah. So actually, you know, there is exactly where education could have helped you. But I think equally when, you know, we're seeing more and more women coming to motherhood later now and starting to conceive in their 30s. And that can be absolutely fine for the majority.
Mm.
But you are coming to conceiving in the latter part of your fertility life cycle.
Yeah.
And therefore, it is likely to take longer. It's likely to be harder. If it doesn't work, you're running out of time to sort it out. And people just do not understand that enough. They don't understand enough about what reproductive science can or cannot do.
Yeah.
I mean,
because it will only take us so far before actually nature takes over. But also the fact that fertility is the core of us as women.
Yeah.
And it affects so much of us, you know, from our moods. There's so much we can learn from our monthly cycle that I knew nothing about until I was sat on that chair, you know, with a gynecologist who was showing me my ovaries, telling me what to look out for in a monthly cycle. I had no idea.
And there seems to be this sort of culture that, well, we better not tell women because otherwise they're all going to rush out and get pregnant. And I just say that's absolutely not true. Young people can hold both things in their head at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing such an incredible job, Jessica, and I'm so pleased that we met. And that we, you know, we together will keep campaigning and keep the conversation going. You're off. So one of my things I was thinking is, will you ever stop? So you're off to climb Mount Everest.
Yeah,
is
well,
that your next?
I got a bit of a taste for these endurance challenges. So yes, I'm now doing another one. I'm training to climb Mount Everest in 2020. Oh, and if your podcast is running in 2020, I can come back and talk to you about that.
Oh, amazing. So there's just a couple of questions I just wanted to ask just to finish off my podcast today. So what advice would you give to someone hoping to start a family?
What advice would I give someone hoping to start a family? start. Don't put it off.
Yeah.
Don't wait for the perfect time. There's never a perfect time.
Mm-hmm.
If you do find yourself struggling to conceive, do your research. You know, time is ticking, but also you're likely to be on this roller coaster, as we call it, for a while. And, you know, really make sure you get yourself in the best physical and mental shape, exactly as you say, Izzy, for yourself,
mm-hmm.
not whether it will get you pregnant or not, because it will just make you feel better.
Yeah.
Find the right clinic for you. And as we've talked about, don't stop living while you're trying.
Yeah.
Don't give up on Project You for Project Baby,
mm.
because life is about many things. And this is a really important one.
Yeah.
But there are other things.
What is the worst thing anyone said to you when you were trying for a baby?
Oh, it's so hard because I don't know. I just want to, like, I want to forgive anyone who said, you know, there are all those things like, oh, well, it was, maybe it's meant to be, or just relax and it will happen, or, you know, these.
This happened to my friend.
Oh, yes, and then suddenly they went away and got pregnant. You know, like those things are never said with malice, you know?
Yeah. So if we flip it, what would be the right thing to say to someone?
The right thing to say is, how are you doing today? You know, to connect, you know, to never stop talking. But there is no, in the same way, there is no right thing. I think that just the important thing
is to talk. Yeah.
And find your way through it.
Yeah.
And some people you will, you know, ask the question as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need to ask the question.
Yeah. What is the kindest thing you can do for yourself when you are going through fertility struggles?
I think the kindest thing that you can do for yourself, but it's the hardest thing, is to just know that, like, this is out of your control to some extent. And, like, let it, you know, just be gentle on yourself. You've done nothing, you know, like, if you're in the 2-week wait and you worry that you've, like, done something that might have affected it, no, you haven't. If you have an extra glass of wine and you think, oh, no, that's going to jeopardize it, no, you haven't. You know, nature is ultimately in control of this journey, not you. And so if you can, give yourself a break. But if you do beat yourself up, give yourself a break from, like, beating yourself up for beating yourself up, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever you feel is normal.
And what is your mantra?
Oh, my mantra is, well, I have so many, but, like, I'll just let me, you know, my mantra is that everyone has hard stuff in your life. And if this is your hard thing, it's shit. But there's so much to enjoy on this planet in this short time that we're here. There really is. So go out and find something to give you joy, to counteract the thing that is really shit and is never going away.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for talking with so much heart.
Aww.
And something I just would like to do at the end of all my podcasts, because I think we are so emotionally you know, the whole topic is so much for us to take that I just want to do a little mindfulness exercise with you. Yeah. So if we put one hand on our heart, and anyone that's listening who might have found listening a bit tough, or you're going through it, if we put one hand on our heart, one hand on our tummy, and we can say the words, may we be happy. May we be healthy. May we be calm. May we be safe.